So the title of this course is Thriving in a Living Universe. And it is essentially a course on the art of manifestation. And tonight in our first session, we're going to explore the question, what is a living universe? What does that mean? Before I get into it, I'd like to say briefly what my background is with this art of manifestation, because I really do come to it honestly. My parents were married by Norman Vincent Peale, who was the author of the book The Power of Positive Thinking, which back in the 30s and 40s and 50s was almost a textbook on manifestation for a great many people. And it certainly had a pride of place in my father's library. And then in 1970, I went to Findhorn, where I became a co-director of this intentional spiritual community in the north of Scotland, along with Peter Caddy, one of the three original founders. And Findhorn was a place that was built on a foundation of the practice of manifestation. And Peter would regularly give talks on manifestation. And he would take visitors around the community and he would point out all the bungalows, the community center, the flowers, his car, all the many things that had come into the community's possession by utilizing the art of manifestation. But the way Peter taught it was what we came to call the old laws. And essentially, they were built around a tripartite use of visualization, of the application of one-pointed will, and the law of attraction. And while I was there, I had an occasion to try to manifest a typewriter. I needed a typewriter because Peter was asking me to undertake various chores of writing. And he said, you can use the laws of manifestation to do this, David. And I said, well, yes, I can. And actually, I've been doing this too for many years, but I use a different method. And so I used my method, which up to that time I had never really articulated. And within a matter of days, the typewriter did in fact materialize. So in talking this over with Peter, he said, well, David, I'd like you to give a series of talks on, well, let's call them the new laws of manifestation. And those talks were eventually gathered into a book called The Laws of Manifestation. Not terribly original, but certainly to the point. And that was one of the first books of mine that Findhorn published, and it was a collection of lectures. A few years ago, it was reissued by a Wiser with new material from me, and the lectures somewhat better edited. And it's out there, and it's still called The Laws of Manifestation. Then many years went by, easily 20 years, without me doing very much with this topic. And then I was invited to give a weekend course for a church on manifestation. And this gave me an opportunity to think into this process again and to begin to formulate in a more considered way what my approach was. And the result of that ultimately was a new book called Everyday Miracles. And to bring us up to date, in recent years working with Jeremy Berg and his daughter Deva, We produced a card deck, the manifestation card deck, with which you are familiar because we'll be using it in this class. And the card deck encapsulates and extends, in some ways, the material that was contained in Everyday Miracles. So that's a short history of how we come to this point. My approach is based on a vision of the universe as a living presence, one that is filled with sentient energy. And that sentient energy is responsive to our thoughts and our feelings, indeed to the whole presence of our being. So manifestation for me is a cooperative venture with this presence, and it's based on connection and relationship and a caring partnership. And all of this will become very clear as we go through the card deck in the ensuing sessions of this course. But how did this particular approach come about? So I want to begin my story with a tale of three worlds. The first world is the oldest world, the one that humanity has inhabited for millennia. And it's the world in which nature has dominated. And I don't know if you were able to get it, speaking parenthetically, but I, at the last moment, sent Ru a picture. Oh, yep, looks like you have it, showing the three worlds. So in the first one, you see the large circle of nature and a little tiny circle of humanity. And this was the state in which human beings lived for thousands and thousands of years. And it was a world in which we knew our place as part of the great chain of being, as part of the natural environment. And if it came down to a contest between human beings and nature, nature invariably won. In the 1700s, however, a new world began to emerge. And that's the world that we've been inhabiting for the past 300 years, approximately. And this world began with the emergence of science and the scientific method, and also with the age of reason and the age of enlightenment, which began to redefine and revision the nature of the human being. And this period in our Western history gave birth to a great many movements. It was when John Locke, the English philosopher, was writing, and his works became seminal for the founding fathers of this country. So a great many ideas began to emerge during this period, but they all clustered around a central theme which could be expressed somewhat simplistically in this way. Nature is a great machine. The world is a great machine ordered by laws and principles, and human beings can understand those laws and principles in ways that give an individual control over nature, control over this machine. Now, obviously, this control is somewhat hit and miss. We only have to look at the consequences of a hurricane like Katrina or Sandy last year to see that we're not as dominant as we may like to think ourselves as being. And certainly with the specter of global climate change, this truth is being pressed in upon us even more. But nevertheless, there arose in the 17th and 18th centuries this attitude that there was ultimately no limit to what human beings could do through the avenue of science and technology to control nature, And I remember well growing up in the 50s, the late 40s and 50s, and being told in school and in popular articles in magazines and certainly in science fiction that well before the beginning of the 21st century, human beings would have learned how to control the weather. We could turn rain on and off at will, turn the clouds on and off at will, and essentially nature would be another device that humanity could dominate and control to shape a world according to human wishes and needs. And of course, we look around today and can ask the question, what happened to that future? It certainly did not manifest, and we're probably all the better because it didn't. At the same time that human beings were, in the West certainly, were discovering their power through science, there was an equivalent movement in the esoteric and spiritual fields, which put emphasis on the individual and the power within the individual, and began to promote an idea called the magical will, that a person could, through training and development, bring forth from within himself or herself a magical will, a will so focused and developed and strong that the interior elements of the world, the nature spirits, the elementals, the subtle side of the world, would bow before this individual. We see a critique of this image in Fantasia when Mickey Mouse becomes the sorcerer's apprentice and attempts to wield these powers, and he has this dream. If you remember the movie, he falls asleep while his magically empowered brooms are continually bringing water in from the well, but he falls asleep and imagines himself at the summit of a mountaintop, sweeping his hands across the heavens, and stars fall to the right and stars fall to the left, and the waves are under his control until suddenly one wave knocks over his chair and wakes him up, and he realizes he's not in control at all. So this was this whole story was a kind of warning against this image of the supreme magician whose will put him or her in charge of all the elements. But the warning came about because that was the image that was being fostered. We first find it in the writings of Levy, who published his books in the 1850s, and his works on magic greatly influenced the British Esoteric Society, the Order of the Golden Dawn, which influenced Dion Fortune, and so on down that particular lineage. But it's not confined only to those groups or to that lineage. It became a kind of socially accepted image of the powerful individual who could go forth and remake the world in his or her likeness. And we're still in the tail end of that world. We still have that kind of hubris at work, and we can see it around us. But we're also at the dawning of what could be called the third world. And the third world is an emerging worldview, one that sees the world as a living organism and approaches it not through an attitude of domination and willpower, but through an attitude of cooperation and heart-filled, soul-filled partnership. And we're just at the early days of this world, but this is the image that I believe is going to eventually become the dominant one in our culture, for no other reason than it's the only image that offers us a real chance of dealing with the global ecological issues that confront us, which evidence is mounting simply cannot be dealt with through domination. Now, in all three of these worlds, there's life. Life is recognized as existing. And in the first world, everything is alive, everything is ensouled. It's an animistic world. It's filled with sentiency that is not limited to organic beings. So the hills, the mountains, the rivers, the oceans all had their spirits. The trees had their spirits, the wind had its spirit, and so on. And human beings needed to come to terms with those invisible powers. In that world, the appearance of humanity could be considered a threshold, because with the appearance of our species and our particular talents of imagination and thought, coupled with an opposable thumb and our ability to manipulate the world around us, we began to introduce change, slowly at first, but accelerating, in ways and in directions that nature had not done for itself prior to that point. So in an interesting way, humanity appeared and was nourished and held and was an intrinsic part of this first world, a part of nature. But the nature of our species was such that we carried within us the seeds of transformation and of changing that world into something else. Now, it did not have to change into the materialistic world that has come to define what I call the second worldview, but it did. Historically, it did. And in the second world, life is constrained. It is constricted to existing only within organic beings. So now rocks and landscapes and weather no longer have spirits associated with them, are no longer considered to be alive. The world is material, it's physical, it's chemical, it's biological. It is not seen as a living entity. The world is seen as an economic resource. That is, it's a kind of a bank from which humanity can draw what it needs for its own uses. And in this world, as I say, nature is controlled and shaped and managed. And the threshold that really makes this world possible was the appearance of the methodologies of science and the technologies to which it gave birth. And, in addition, the particular vision of what constituted a human being, the image of ourselves as possessing this inner power and will and capability to shape and dominate the world around us. The third world might seem like it's a return, like we've gone full circle, back to the animistic world of our ancestors, but actually we've gone up a notch on a spiral. The third world is one where the threshold that leads into it could be identified as the appearance of the science of ecology, systems and chaos theory, and the Gaia hypothesis. All of these combine to create an image of a holistic world that is itself an organism. And even though the Gaia that's proposed in the Gaia hypothesis, now the Gaia theory, because there has been sufficient evidence in proof of it, that it is no longer hypothetical, the kind of organism that is proposed is not really a sentient one. It's, as Dr. Lynn Margulis, the microbiologist, once said to me, the Gaia is like a planet-sized amoeba, and it has unconscious responses. It's not a truly intelligent entity. This is where a fourth world comes into play. And the fourth world is not a sequential one like the other three. It's not like we've passed through one, two, and three, and now there's a fourth. The fourth world has been underneath all the other three. And that fourth world is what I call the subtle worlds. It's the world of non-physical reality and the world of those beings that populate it. At one time, this world was very well known to our ancestors and in many ways feared because it just seemed that it held all the power. But we've come through this second world, and one of the benefits of the second world has been to empower humanity, to give us a chance to see ourselves not as the subjects of nature. The challenge has been that we've gone too far and we see ourselves as the masters of nature. But now we're coming around to a place where we can begin to see ourselves as partners with the world, partners with nature. The thing about the subtle worlds is that it is an ecology the same as the physical environment that we see about us. This is not the way we usually think about it. We've been conditioned for really thousands of years, largely through religious and magical traditions, to see this world in hierarchical terms, that it is above us, and it's where the experts live, so to speak. It's where the higher powers and forces that truly shape this world have their dwelling. The realm of the sky gods, if you wish. But the subtle worlds are really, from my experience, and I've been experiencing them now for close to, well over 60 years, they're just, and I don't mean to minimize them by saying this, but they are an ecosystem, and they are filled with life forms and organisms of consciousness, for sure. They're not physical, they're not biological, but they are beings of energy, beings of thought, beings of consciousness. But they have their laws and principles, they have their metabolism, they have their, if I may use the word, their physiology. They are, in fact, true organisms, the same that we are. The main difference being that we are expressing through physical bodies, and they are expressing through bodies of a different kind of substance. Our Western world, coming out of the materialist worldview, has pretty much lost sight of this second ecology, what I call the Earth's second ecology. Or, when we do think about it, we do so in terms of horror stories and fearful imaginings. In some ways, though Hollywood has certainly opened its doors to the idea of non-physical beings, it presents them in such horrific ways that as a teacher, when I work with people to consider partnership with the subtle worlds, I have to move through, more often than not, a set of thought forms which boiled down to, well, aren't the subtle worlds filled with monsters and evil beings who are just waiting to possess me? And the answer is no. In fact, the vast majority of subtle beings, in my experience, actually have very little interest in us, or for that matter, may not even know that we exist, because we can be as insubstantial to them as they are to us. But that's a whole other topic. The point here is that the planet on which we live is bursting with life and bursting with consciousness. And this consciousness exists in many different ways and in many forms, some of which are physical and some of which are not. And the upshot of that is that I am in constant relationship, and you are in constant relationship. We all are in constant relationship every day through our own energetic nature, the part of us that always lives as part of this second ecology anyway, with this non-physical universe. We are daily in touch with and interacting with the invisible intelligence of the world. Not necessarily with specific beings, I don't want to give that impression, but we live in a sea of intelligence, a sea of awareness and sentiency, and it shapes our lives and we shape it in a continuing conversation. So manifestation is a way of approaching this conversation in a deliberate and mindful and meaningful way, and to come to it by saying, I'm not one who's here to dominate you. I am not the master here, but I'm not the slave either. I'm your partner. And it is this collaborative stance that underlies my approach to manifestation. So this was one of the changes. This is what became apparent when I was at Findhorn. Because the laws of manifestation that Peter Caddy taught and had learned himself from his Rosicrucian beginnings was one that definitely reflected the second world attitude of control and domination over inner forces in order to secure what you wanted. And if you did it with good intent, it was white magic, and if you did it with bad intent, it was black magic. But the principles were basically the same. So manifestation was an exercise of the will to generate a powerful enough image of what you wanted that the sentiency of the planet, so to speak, would respond and in some way shape itself to bring this about. And I realized that this wasn't how I thought, that my years of engagement with the subtle worlds had imbued in me a sense of this partnership, and that we were collaborators in helping things to emerge, and that manifestation was an expression of this collaboration. Now, in what way does this make this a living universe? What exactly is life in this context? If inorganic materials like my coffee cup or my chair or my sofa can be considered alive, what does that say about the meaning of life? When we say that everything in the world is alive, it's certainly not alive in the same way that you and I are. It's not biological life. And the consciousness that one can find in a coffee cup or in a chair or a sofa or a stone or indeed in anything is certainly not comparable to the consciousness that a human being has. Any more than our consciousness is comparable to, say, the consciousness of Gaia, the world soul, or the consciousness of an archangelic being. To Gaia, we may have as little consciousness as we think a coffee cup has. So this is all very relative. But if I look at my coffee cup and bring to bear upon it inner perception, I find that there are layers. And the very first layer that I run into is what I could call the Velcro layer. And I call it that because it's a layer of subtle energy that simply picks up and holds for a period of time. How long is subject to various other factors, the energies that are in its immediate environment. So for example, if I'm sitting here at my desk and I'm holding my coffee cup and it's here on my desk and I'm loving it and I'm loving what I'm doing and the atmosphere of this immediate environment is filled with this lovingness, then that's what the Velcro layer will pick up. It will, if somebody who could psychometrize could pick up my coffee cup, they might be able to sense this loving energy. If I'm sitting here staring at a white page on the screen and nothing's happening with my writing and I'm feeling blocked and frustrated and I'm exuding that energy of frustration, then that might be what my coffee cup picks up. The fact is that everything, including ourselves, has this Velcro layer. We're always picking up stuff, energetic stuff from our environment, and all the things in our environment are doing that as well. It doesn't necessarily stay. The subtle environment is in many ways quite fluid, and so things that are not fixed in some fashion generally dissipate fairly quickly. But nevertheless, everything around us at this layer is picking up subtle energy. It's picking up the consequences, if you wish, the radiation or the vibration. We actually don't really have good words to describe this phenomenon that arise out of, in this instance, human thinking and feeling. Now, if I really go deeply in looking at my coffee cup and trying to attune to the life within it, I might find myself in touch with the sacredness at its core. Now, this is not specifically the sacredness of the coffee cup. Rather, it's the presence of the universal generative mystery, the universal living substance out of which everything comes. So whether it's a glass or a desk or a chair or a human being or a tree or a cat, it all ultimately is composed of this fundamental substance and is emerging out of this sacred substance. We could just call it light for want of a better word. If I find myself in touch with that, I'm in touch with the universal quality of life, and in a sense, I've gone too far. I've overshot the mark. On the one hand, I was in touch with simply a layer of energetic impressions that have been left upon the coffee cup by things going on in its environment. On the other hand, I've gone very deeply, mystically into it, and I'm in touch with this universal source. I could certainly call that life. And in that sense, truly everything is alive, but it is the life of the Creator. But in terms of understanding the life of the coffee cup, the secret life of my coffee cup, I've gone too far. So I want to back up a bit. In astronomy, there's this wonderful image of the habitable zone around a star. This is the zone in which a planet is neither too close to the star and therefore too hot, or too far away and therefore too cold for life as we know it. And the term that astronomers give to this when they're being whimsical is the Goldilocks zone, because, you know, Goldilocks was looking for the porridge that wasn't too hot or too cold, but was just right. And so this habitable zone around a star is where conditions are just right for the appearance of life as we would know it. Well, there's something similar in my coffee cup, or in my chair, or in the sofa, or in my computer keyboard, or in the tree, or the cat, or even in ourselves. And this is where a certain complexity of energy and of organization exists sufficiently that it can be aware of being touched by consciousness, touched by another living presence, and it can respond accordingly. Sometimes that's all it can do. In this sense, it might be very much like an amoeba, although I hesitate to use that example because actually amoebas are extremely complex little critters and have a range of reactions to their environment. But we tend to think of them as simple. Well, I'll give you another example. Yesterday I was out walking and I came across an earthworm moving across the sidewalk. And I thought, I need to pick you up and put you in the grass. Otherwise, you're going to be a tasty morsel for a bird, or someone more likely will step on you. And when the earthworm was strung out full length, and when I touched it, it immediately contracted. And if you've ever touched an earthworm, you've seen them do this. It contracts into a tight little ball, which ironically it makes it easier to pick up. But this earthworm, you know, it's not knowing what's touching it. It's not saying, oh my gosh, here's a human being named David Spangler who is touching me. It has simply registered a touch. And its automatic response is to curl up into a defensive posture. So the kind of life that exists in my coffee cup or in my sofa is that kind of consciousness. But it does exist, and it exists at a certain layer of energy that's not too deep, so it's not, I'm not in touch with universal life, the cosmic life of all creation, and it's not too shallow, so I'm not in touch with just the surface buzz that the Velcro layer picks up, but I'm in touch with a layer of organization, of energy and living energy, sentient energy, that is able to have some degree of awareness, not necessarily of the physical world around it, but of the energetic world around it. In some ways, it could be said that all our consciousnesses began in that simple place billions of years ago, and we have evolved to where we are today. And perhaps the consciousness in my coffee cup will one day be a David Spangler on another planet giving a talk on manifestation. And who knows, billions and billions of years ago, I might have been in a coffee cup of an alien writer in some far distant galaxy. This is kind of fanciful, and it's meant to be fanciful, but to convey the fact that we live in a world of sentient living energy, which takes a variety of forms, the fact that some of those forms at a physical level seem inert to us does not mean that they are inert inwardly. There's a fourth layer involved here. I call it the writer layer. And what that means is that it's possible for certain inner beings to make a contact with a thing, with an object in our environment, and use it as a way to interact with us, basically. And this is the whole science behind the creation of talismans. But it's possible, it's not true in this case, but it's certainly possible that my coffee cup could have some elemental being that decides to use it as an entryway into the world of human consciousness or human energy at any rate. Where I did find this was with the stuffed animals of my children, that because of the love and the relationship that they established with these stuffed animals, I became aware over a period of time that there were actual subtle beings that had associated themselves with these animals. Now, this does not mean that they were living in the animal, not that, like the stuffed animal was their incarnation. It just meant there was a thread of energy that connected their consciousness to the animal and through the animal to the consciousness and energy field of my children. And these were lovely beings whose delight really was to be playful and to be engaged with the energy of children. And once I realized that was happening, whenever I bought a stuffed animal to give to the child of a friend, I would always make a point of inviting, never imposing, never forcing, but always just inviting such a friendly entity, if it wished, to form a connection with this stuffed animal as a blessing for the child for whom it was intended. So it is possible, when tuning into the life of an object, to actually contact one of these subtle beings. And that can be a little confusing if you're not aware of what's happening. It can suddenly look as if, oh my gosh, my coffee cup is really the home of this being. And that's the coffee cup. I mean, this being is the coffee cup. But it's not. It is something else that has its own native level in the subtle world, its own niche in the subtle ecology. And for various reasons, it has formed an attachment with an object that one of us owns, that a human being owns. In our materialist world, this kind of discussion is very strange and seems fanciful. But in the world in which manifestation works, it's very relevant, because manifestation operates beyond the capabilities of touch and physical action. I mean, that's really the whole purpose behind it. If I want to manifest a loaf of bread, I can easily go down to the grocery store and buy one. That's manifestation, because something that I did not have, I now have. It has made an appearance. It has manifested in my kitchen. But if there are no grocery stores nearby selling bread, and I'm not able to bake it, then I might have to look to some other means. I want to engage with the living energy of the universe, of the world around me, to see if in fact something can happen, a chain of probabilities. We'll be talking more about this in the sessions ahead, will come alive, and along that chain will come what is necessary to bring the bread into my possession. So when we're talking about manifestation, we're talking about working with the subtle side of life. And that means working with a living, sentient, aware consciousness and presence. Not necessarily a being, but certainly in our case, a planetary presence, the living energy that flows through this world and which consciousness can shape. We'll be talking more about that next week in the second session. Tonight, I simply wanted to lay out a context, to say a little bit about my background, and to say a good deal more about the nature of this living universe in which we now seek to thrive. Next week, we'll be looking at how we form our intention. How do we decide what thriving means to us and what it is that we need to do to begin setting into motion this manifestation project? And then in the weeks that follow, in the sessions that follow, we'll be going through the card deck in a systematic and orderly way and using the cards to illustrate some of the principles of how we converse with and collaborate with the life that is all around us. So thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to share this, and I'm looking forward to all the sessions we have ahead of us and to what we will manifest together. Thank you.